This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Welcome to ER Vet on Pet Life Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Justine Lee. Thanks for joining us. Today, I'm really excited to be speaking with the author of The Vet at Noah's Ark, Dr. Doug Mader. We'll be right back after these messages.
Take a bite out of your competition. Advertise your business with an ad in Pet Life Radio podcasts and radio shows. There is no other pet-related media that is as large and reaches more pet parents and pet lovers than Pet Life Radio. With over 7 million monthly listeners, Pet Life Radio podcasts are available on all major podcast platforms. And our live radio stream goes out to over 250 million subscribers on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, TuneIn, and other streaming apps. For more information on how you can advertise on the number one pet podcast and radio network, visit PetLifeRadio.com/advertise today.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to ER Vet on Pet Life Radio. I'm super excited to speak with one of my favorite exotics veterinary colleagues, Dr. Doug Mader, who is the author of this incredible book that I just finished reading called The Vet at Noah's Ark. If you guys have never heard or read his book, you've got to check it out. You can check it out on his website at dougmader.com, on Amazon. I read this book recently, and it really reminded me of a modern day version of James Herriot. So with that, Dr. Mader, thank you so much for joining us today.
Justine, thank you for having me on your show. It's quite an honor and a privilege. I really appreciate it.
Of course. You know, it was so interesting. I learned so many things about you when I read this book. But just so our audience knows who you are, do you mind giving us a little bit of background about who you are, what you do, what your triple board certification is in, and give us a little bit of a intro about what The Vet at Noah's Ark, Stories of Survival from an Inner City Animal Hospital is about?
Oh, absolutely. Be happy to. Well, I'm a veterinarian. I've been a veterinarian for almost four decades now. I went to UC Davis. And I was born in the Florida Keys, and after living all over the country, I ended up moving back here to the Florida Keys about 25 years ago. And for the last 25 years, I've had a referral practice in the Keys, and we see exotics. And I'm the only boarded veterinarian in the Keys. I'm boarded in ABVP, canine feline, ABVP, reptile amphibian, and European College of Zoo Medicine with a subspecialty in herpetology. So our hospital has been a 24-hour emergency hospital, and we do general practice during the day. And then I always just see referral cases.
For those of you guys who don't know what all those letters stand for, they usually stand for Diplomat of the American College of X, Y, and Z. So for example, I'm an emergency critical care specialist. So I'm a Diplomat of the American Board of Emergency Critical Care. And so when you see those extra letters, it means not only did that veterinarian go through undergraduate veterinary school, but they've oftentimes done an internship, and then they've had to do some type of advanced training to become really an expert in that area. So you guys are talking to the guru when it comes to exotics animals. Now, Dr. Mader, when you wrote this book, first of all, it was really a compilation of different stories of cases that you've seen. And I know you treat everything from dogs and cats to emus and skunks and snakes and monkeys and just about everything out there. Give me a little bit of background about why you decided to go into exotics medicine and what your favorite exotics or pocket pet is.
Well, I didn't know we had 4 hours. That's great. thanks for that. First of all, please call me Doug. I always seem to shock people. I started my career as an equine veterinarian, and then I was run over by an underage drunken driver. And a year and 11 surgeries later, I just didn't have the physical wherewithal to work with horses anymore. And during my convalescence, I started volunteering at the zoo ward. And as I just mentioned, I was born in the Florida Keys. And so I grew up playing in the swamps with my older brother, chasing birds and snakes and frogs and you name it. So getting back and during my recovery after the accident, working in the zoo ward, I really, really enjoyed working with the exotics. So I decided to go ahead and pursue zoo animal medicine as possibly my career track, since I couldn't do horses anymore. I was just too broken. And once I got into private practice, I realized, you know, I like to teach, I like to write. And way back then, the other veterinary specialists didn't give people with exotics a lot of credibility. And I wanted to have that credibility when I spoke and when I wrote. So I went ahead and studied for and applied for and sat for the board specialty in canine feline practice with the American Board of Veterinary Practitioners. And that's kind of what the background of the book is about, was the year that I applied for, qualified for, studied for, and then took the ABVP canine feline test. And then that was set into the background of living in the inner city of Los Angeles and around the tumult of the social unrest of the Rodney King riots. So all the stories in the book, everything that happened is 100% true. And all those cases that I talk about during the book happened during a period of 1 year. So that's one of the amazing things about living in a big city, is that, boy, you stay busy.
It's so interesting. When I read your book and I saw all the stories about when you were studying for boards, it actually made me cringe, because it gave me all these memories of me studying for my board certification. And it's so much work, and trying to fit that in while you, you know, run a busy practice. I can't even imagine. It must have been exhausting.
You try and, you know, I'd always carry a pocket full of notes with me, and in between cases, or when I take a potty break and sit down to do my duty, you know, I'd sit and I'd be reading. It's like every chance you get, you're reading, looking at you know, memory cards, you know. It's just constant learning. And the thing is, I encourage everybody to try and pursue advanced training, because, you know, even if you don't pass the test, you're still a better veterinarian for trying.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because when I was sitting for my toxicology boards, I was fishing from a canoe in the Boundary Waters canoe area. And I was literally casting, flipping through pages. And my husband was just shaking his head like, can't you just relax? So I totally get it. So what I wanted to talk to you about today are some of the things that we see in the emergency room. And I will say, in the ER, I'll oftentimes see birds to reptiles to you name it, we see it. I wanted to first of all start with reptiles in the ER. First of all, what are some of the most common emergency situations that warrant bringing in your reptile into the emergency room? In other words, what constitutes a reptile emergency?
That's a great question. You know, one thing you have to realize is that, you know, reptiles do everything slow. They get sick slow, they get better slow. And most of the time, when they get sick, you've got time to get them to the veterinarian, as long as you don't waste a month. You know, I'm saying that somewhat flippant, but I'm being serious, because they generally get sick pretty slowly. When you have true emergencies, I would say probably by far the most common true emergencies in reptile medicine are traumas. So you get the tortoise that's attacked by the dog, or, you know, maybe the little lizard that was accidentally dropped by a small child, you know, a trauma situation that can't wait. That needs to be brought in right away, especially if you have acute hemorrhage. You know, oftentimes those need to be brought in. Now, the beauty of being a reptile compared to a dog or a cat is you can have a reptile nearly bleed out and come in with a PCV of 5%, and that animal still got a really good prognosis, you know, and without a transfusion. They just amazing how their metabolism works and how well they heal.
Now, for those of you guys who don't know, what exactly is packed cell volume, and what's normal for a reptile?
Oh, I'm sorry. Packed cell volume is the percentage of red cells that they have. And it really depends. The normals really depend on the which of the 13,000 species. I have almost all of them committed to memory. That's a joke. But I would say probably it should be in the 25 to 40% range, depending on the species. And so, I mean, like in dogs and cats, if you get an animal coming in at 15%, you start thinking transfusion. And at 5%, I'm not thinking transfusion in a reptile. I'm just thinking, okay, supportive care and hemotonics, which are medications that'll help augment the production of new cells. Most of these guys respond beautifully.
All right. Now, one thing I'll oftentimes see besides trauma is inadvertent trauma. Like all of a sudden, an owner will notice that a leg is at a different angle, or they barely took a step and the leg breaks. Can you talk to me about metabolic bone disease in reptiles?
Okay, sure. First off, I'm going to be a nerd and tell you that there is no such thing as metabolic bone disease. That's one of those terms that's been thrown around for years and years. The term metabolic bone disease is a description. So if I say metabolic bone disease, it could be osteoporosis, osteopetrosis, nutritional secondary hyperparathyroidism, osteomalacia. You get my point. So when the layperson talks about metabolic bone disease. In fact, 99% of the time, what they're talking about is nutritional secondary hyperparathyroidism, which is where there's an imbalance of vitamin D, calcium, phosphorus, and temperature. And the bones either don't develop normally, which would be called rickets in mammal medicine, or they start to develop and then they start to dissolve because they don't have all the proper nutrients and variables that they need to stay strong. So that would be an osteomalacia. So what happens is when the bone loses approximately 40% of its normal matrix, which is what makes them strong, then they become weak, and then these animals are prone to what's called pathological fractures, which means the bone is weak, and then, again, some small child maybe drops the lizard or closes the lid on the snake too quickly and snaps the back in half. It would be like an elder woman postmenopausal that slips and falls and breaks her hip or breaks her wrist. So basically, it's an acute trauma on a chronic problem.
All right. Thank you. And I know we probably don't have time to talk about it, but what's the biggest mistake that you see when it comes to feeding reptiles or their general husbandry or how they're cared for?
Probably the biggest mistake is we tend to feed them a contrived diet that's convenient for us and not necessarily an appropriate diet that they would normally eat in the wild. For example, people tend to throw their bearded dragons, crickets, and mealworms, where in the wild, they're predominantly a herbivore and a vegetarian. You know, and a lot of that, unfortunately, too, is propagated by pet stores because, you know, they want to sell you what they can sell and make a profit on, as opposed to send you to the grocery store to buy proper healthy vegetables. And then the other thing is just heat. These guys are ectothermic. The old term is cold-blooded. That's not true. And every reptile has a specific temperature zone where they are active, they reproduce, they eat, they digest properly. And if they're not in that proper temperature zone, none of these functions operate normally.
Now, I did want to ask, what's the general workup? Like, what do I do in the ER vet if I happen to see a reptile that I suspect has trauma related to nutritional issues? What should I prepare a pet owner for?
Well, I think, you know, you should approach it the same way you do a dog and a cat. And I'm just going to take a sidestep here for a minute. When I have students come through, vet students come through, they all say, well, we just want to work on exotics. We don't want to do dogs and cats. I say, well, there's the door. What? They're all shocked. And I said, you need to know your dog and cat medicine before you're ever going to do exotics, because you've got to be a good sound doctor first. So if an exotic comes in the door, whether it's a bird, a reptile, a small mammal, talk about husbandry, talk about diet. Once you get that established, many times you're going to find the answer right there just with history alone. Then your standard workup, you know, if you suspect trauma, radiographs are appropriate. If necessary, sedation first and then radiographs so you don't stress them. You know, try and keep that fear-free mentality at working with them, because reptiles go through the same anxiety as dogs and cats do.
I also love that part of your book of when you talk about all the visiting veterinary students, what we often call externs that usually visit for 2 to 4 weeks. And it was so interesting to see how many students that you had externing. I'm sure they learned a ton from you. What do you generally, I know this ER vet show is really designed for pet owners, but what's your general, like, one or two words of wisdom besides, you know, knowing your dogs and cats also when it comes to veterinary students who may be listening to this podcast?
Well, I think it's important for vet students to not forget their medicine. And like I said earlier, you know, just mentioned that a lot of times veterinary students, they like the allure of working with exotic pets because it sounds really cool. It's got a high cool factor, but they really, really, really need to make sure that they're good doctors first. And, you know, over the years, I've hired hundreds of, probably at least 100 associate veterinarians. And I would never hire somebody right out of school. I wanted them to have at least a year dog and cat experience first, because they have to know how to work up a case. And I think that's important for pet owners. When you're shopping around for a good exotic pet doctor, make sure that they have experience as a veterinarian and not just treating parakeets.
All right. Thank you so much. Now, I hope you don't mind me asking. I am terrified of birds. And when birds come into the ER, I'm like always nervous about seeing them. In your book, you talk about everything from, you know, emus to small birds. What's your general philosophy when it comes to bird ownership? What should a potential bird owner know? And tell me 3 or 4 mistakes that you see that pet owners make when it comes to bird ownership.
Oh, I think probably the most important thing is they have to know what they want in a companion, because birds are incredibly, incredibly intelligent. And I think it's important that people realize the fact that these birds are so bright and they can pick up on your feelings and emotions, and they're birds also have incredibly sensitive feelings, and they can get upset and distressed too when an owner is upset. So the big question you have to ask yourself is, what are you looking for? Do I want to get a canary that's going to live 10 to 12 years, that'll sit in a cage, doesn't need a lot of personal attention, will entertain me by singing all day? Or do I want a macaw that's going to live 70 to 80 years, that will I have to put it in my will or find a home for, that's going to be basically like maintaining a two-year-old for the next, you know, several decades? So that's probably the number one mistake is they make, is they may overbuy the bird. In other words, I think it'd be cool to have a macaw, and then once they get it, they realize, oh, geez, this is a lot of work. The other thing is, you know, diet. People tend to feed birds a lot of the wrong foods, and I do know of some avian veterinarians that will disagree with me, but, you know, with rare exception, birds don't eat dairy products, and I frequently see people give their birds cheese. And ask yourself, where would a parakeet eat cheese in the wild? You know, have you ever seen a parakeet milk a cow? Again, you'll see people give their African greys chicken. It's like, okay, have you ever seen a parrot take down a chicken or a bird in the wild and eat the meat? No. And so you have to understand the physiology of the kidneys of these animals. Then you start throwing animal protein at them, you're just going to make them sick. So that's one of the, you know, nutrition is really important. And then finally, again, I just want to go back to this mental thing, and that is birds are incredibly, incredibly bright, and they need space, they need attention. And one of the things that I saw during COVID was a lot of people worked from home and they spent a lot of time with their birds. The birds got used to that. And then when they went back to work, the birds got lonely. And then they would start doing abnormal behaviors like feather picking and stereotypical cage behaviors and things like that. So again, birds are very complex animals, much more difficult to keep than fish.
Right. And it's also really hard when you see birds in the wild and then you see them in captivity. They may not get the same amount of environmental enrichment. So I oftentimes will see a lot of behavioral issues, even in the ER. Right. And one of my favorite cases, not being a bird guru at all, was when a beautiful bird came in really, really listless after having a nail trimming. And thankfully, I worked with an amazing veterinary technician who was like, oh, it's from blood loss from having this nail cut too short. And the bird was back to normal the next day. It was really, really neat to see. But yeah, some birds are definitely handled more and are much more friendly. So I always say, talk to an experienced bird owner or a bird veterinarian before you consider getting a bird. Now, oftentimes in the ER, I will also see birds that have egg binding or they're egg bound. Do you mind just talking about that?
Oh, sure. Once again, a lot of that you're going to find probably is nutrition related, because if you think back to your physiology, now dogs and cats don't have, you know, a shell gland, but they're all smooth muscles. And if their nutrition is off, their calcium is off, and it's generally a calcium issue, and they don't have enough ionized calcium, active calcium, they can't do proper smooth muscle contraction, and so they can't lay their eggs. Or if they're severely hypocalcemic, they can't even shell their eggs properly. And so I would say the vast majority of the time it's nutrition based. And once you get that corrected, you can control the problem. And oftentimes these egg binding cases, if you just get them on supplemental calcium, warm them up, make sure they have proper fluids and they're stable, they lay the eggs just fine.
We'll be right back with Dr. Mader right after these messages.
Molly, here's your dinner. Zeus, that's not your food.
Don't let that happen to your precious cat. Elevate your cat's eating experience with the Cat Tree Tray. The Cat Tree Tray keeps your cat's food off the floor and conveniently located on the cat tree. It's the perfect way to eat. It's a beautiful wrought iron tray that easily attaches to your cat tree and keeps dogs and other critters out of your cat's dish. A must for multi-pet households. There's a 6-inch tray for large bowls and a 4-inch tray for smaller bowls. Purchase your Cat Tree Tray today. Go right now to cattreetray.com. That's cattreetray.com. cattreetray.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to ER Vet on Pet Life Radio. We've been talking with Dr. Doug Mader, and we've been talking about his new book, The Vet at Noah's Ark, Stories of Survival from an inner city animal hospital. And for those of you guys who missed the beginning, Dr. Doug Mader is a triple board certified veterinary specialist, and he's authored this fantastic book. It's great for veterinary professionals. It's great for the pet lover in your life. Definitely worth checking out because to me, it is the modern day James Harriet story. So absolutely love it. Now, Dr. Mader, when you first wrote this book, I know it was a compilation of multiple stories. Tell me your favorite story that you included in this book.
Oh, man. Thank you for that comparison with Dr. Harriet. That's the ultimate compliment. That's very kind. You know, there's so many great stories in the book. It's hard to pick just one, but you know, there's happy stories and sad stories, and some of the stories are just hilarious. I think probably one of the best stories in there was involving a dog, and that was the dog that got so sick and then had the bad reactions. We had belonged to a trucker, and he had fed the dog some meat with a large bone in it, and the bone got stuck in the stomach, and then the routine type surgery to remove the bone. But then the dog ended up with a severe reaction to the medication and almost died. And this poor gentleman didn't have a lot of money. And so we worked with him and helped him with the cost and worked with the dog. And I had two fantastic students that donated a lot of time. The bottom line was the dog recovered after having plastic surgery and skin grafting. And it was just such a great feeling to see that dog wag its tail and walk out the door with the owner at the end. You know, we all shoot for that. You know, we all want to walk on water. And when it works, it's such a great feeling.
Now, for those who haven't read the book, do you mind just giving us a little bit of background about the setup, your practice, your partners, your externs? Just give us a big summary of
sure,
this book.
Absolutely. Long story short, you know, I had just finished a residency, and was offered a job at the university. I started working at the university, and I realized I didn't like working in a large institution. I wanted to work for myself. I had a very good friend, and the two of us decided to buy a veterinary hospital. Well, when you're right out of school and you have student debt, you don't have a lot of money and you don't have a lot of credit. So we shopped for hospitals from San Diego to Santa Barbara because we both like Southern California and the coast. We ended up buying this beat up, very, very old hospital in Southern California in the inner city. That's the only thing we could afford. And when we, you'll love this part. I didn't put it in the book, but when we first opened up the hospital, we didn't make any money. So both of us took turns working at the local ER clinic, and we shared our salaries so that we could afford to build the hospital better. Once we got up and running, we had veterinary students coming down, spending time with us. They were great additions to the hospital and great additions to the story because all the students had such great personalities. And because we're in the middle of the city, we had a lot of interesting things happen. I mean, it's good stuff and bad stuff. And the hospital itself was kind of on the cusp between a very affluent part of town and an extremely poor part of town. And the at the time governor, George Duke Majun, was one of our clients. And I remember one day his wife was sitting there with her kitty, and right next to her was a family from the other side of the town when they could barely afford shoes for their kids. So it was quite a colorful environment. So that's why it just lends itself to so many wonderful stories.
One story in there that I found so interesting, and it was about a monkey that had heart disease, and there was involvement with a human surgeon. Do you mind just telling us about that story and the link between animal diseases and similarly the diseases we see in human medicine?
Yeah, actually, it was a monkey and involved an MD, but it was not heart disease. It was spinal disease.
Oh, yeah, spinal disease.
Yeah, it had going back to the
I was thinking of the skunk.
Metabolic bone disease. It had nutritional secondary hyperparathyroidism, and so it had a pathological fracture of the lower back and was paralyzed. And I had an veterinary orthopedic surgeon that I worked with extensively. He didn't want to touch a monkey. My wife was an emergency room nurse, and she worked for several orthopedic surgeons, and she introduced me to one of her bosses who was a pediatric spinal surgeon. So he ended up doing surgery on the monkey for me in my hospital, and things worked out quite well. So it was nice to see the crossover between human medicine and veterinary medicine.
A lot of pet owners aren't aware that oftentimes human medical doctors and surgeons and anesthesiologists and a whole gamut of human healthcare providers will oftentimes donate their time, usually at, you know, tertiary care referral hospitals or academic settings where they'll do open heart surgery or they'll do bypass or, you know, they'll do a lot of advanced procedures that we don't readily have available in veterinary medicine. So I loved when you told that story. I also remember you treating a skunk. Is that correct? Do you mind just giving us a little bit of the background behind that?
We had a woman come in with a pet skunk, and the skunk ended up having heart disease, probably be genetic and maybe even nutritionally related. The interesting thing is the woman that owned skunk was an heir to the Charlie perfume industry. So here's a woman whose whole life and wealth was built up around, you know, beautiful perfumes and odors and aromas. And what pet does she have but a skunk? And so she ended up bringing the skunk in with dilated cardiomyopathy, which is a disease we commonly see in our animal patients, our dog and cat patients. And the student just fell in love with the skunk, and the owner fell in love with the student. And the happy ending was we were able to control the heart disease. The very extremely wealthy owner was so impressed by the young student that she actually offered to pay the student's senior year tuition. So it was kind of a win-win-win story all the way around.
You know, it just goes to show you that regardless of the species, animals and the bond that we have to them, what often we call the human-animal bond, is so important, right? And it can be in any species, whether or not they're feathered or furred or a skunk. So I absolutely love that story. And I thought that fourth-year vet student was quite lucky.
She was. She right place, right time, but she had the personality to make it work. But I just want to echo what you just said, and you nailed it. The human-animal bond isn't just dogs and cats. I mean, I think throughout the book, you can see, I think that's the bottom theme throughout the whole book, is just it's about an incredibly brave group of people working in the inner city, risking life, literally, to work there and take care of these animals, support the human-animal bond. And it was dogs and cats and fish and birds and wildlife, snakes, mice, I mean, you name it. And it just crosses all the different species, and that bond is so important.
Well, thank you so much for writing this book. I heard there's a sequel that's coming out. Is that true?
It sure is. Sure is. This one, the sequel starts with the movie Jurassic Park. Remember that?
I do.
Right. So as soon as that movie came out, everybody ran out and bought a pet dinosaur, aka usually most of them were iguanas. But that's where it starts, and then goes from there. So it also takes place in Los Angeles. And then the third book is being outlined, and that one starts when I move to the Florida Keys.
Wonderful. Well, I can't wait to read it. And for those of you guys who don't have your holiday gifts planned, I know that's months away, but this is seriously the best stocking stuffer for any pet lover in your life. It's such an entertaining book, from the prostitutes in the book to the staff drama to the stories about the externs, to all the amazing animals and the pet owners' lives that you touched. Dr. Mader, thank you so much for all that you do. Where can people find this book?
Hey, Justine, thank you so much for having me here. It's available to any online bookseller like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books & Book. You can go directly to the publisher at Apollo Publishing, or you can go to my website, which is really easy to remember. It's just dougmader.com, and you can order one click order from there.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Fantastic book. And I do truly mean that. And just loved all the stories and loved seeing them in print. So thank you for all that you do.
Thank you.
Well, that brings me to the end of today's show. Find me at drjustinelee.com, on Facebook or Instagram at Dr. Justine Lee, or email me your pet questions, although not your exotics ones, at drjustine@petliferadio.com. With that, we're out of time. And we want to thank Dr. Doug Mader and Mark Winter, our producer, for making this show possible. See you at the next episode.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.